Hello and welcome to Behind the Book, the monthly guest episode of the Creating Happy Writers podcast. Here is where I sit down with brilliant female authors and industry experts who are shaking up the publishing world. In each episode, we explore the powerful ideas and expertise within their books and then uncover the personal story of how they brought that knowledge to the page. Whether you're drafting your business book right now, polishing your manuscript, or dreaming of seeing your expertise in print, these conversations will fuel your creative fire and give you the tools to write with confidence. So join me today for the kind of honest talk about the writing life you won't find anywhere else. Today, I'm joined by Georgia Holleran, who describes herself as having spent her life researching how to make the best of our time on this planet without letting ourselves get in the way. Her background is in the arts, education, neuro-linguistic programming, and cognitive hypnotherapy. Her book, the brilliantly titled The Last Self-Help Book You'll Ever Need, summarizes the best she has learned so far. In this fantastic episode, we explore why traditional self-help often fails to deliver lasting change, the importance of internal work versus external solutions, Georgia's unique triangle theory of personal development, her concept of the 14 ladies, different aspects of self that shape our choices, and also fresh perspectives on understanding ourselves and our creative journeys. So whether you're a writer, a self-help enthusiast, or curious about personal development, this conversation offers valuable insights on growth and authenticity. So let's dive in, shall we? Georgia, thank you so much for joining me. I really want to start with, you approached me, I think 18 months ago, was it?
I'm going to say, this will be May or June, yeah.
Yeah, and you came to me with this incredible idea for a book. You said it was sitting in your head. And the thing that I really want to talk about first is the fact that this book is called The Last Self-Help Book You'll Ever Need. And you came to me so passionate about the self-help industry and how you perceived it to be maybe misguiding people in certain ways about how they could improve themselves, and that you felt this book that you had in you was going to be the last self-help book people would need. So tell me about the origins of the book and how you came to write it.
Mainly, thank you for helping me actually write the book, because that was integral. But yeah, you were a very important part of that. And I think having the conversation, the early conversations with you has actually solidified that. So I wouldn't even know I was that well acquainted with my own book before we started talking about it. But absolutely, I have this strong, as a self-helper victim, all these years, 20, 30 years, or whatever it is. And that takes us right back to the before self-help was even a genre and a bookshop. There's a lot of promise and not a lot of delivery. And it took me some time to figure out where the mismatch was and where the deception was. And I'm going to say that other podcasts would not let me have that. But I believe there is a deception, because I believe people realize that these people who are looking for help can't be helped purely by our book or a course, or they can't be helped by some advice or some one-to-one with even a coach, because the help has to come from you. It's self-help. I think I put in my book, George Carlin said, if you get it from someone else, it's not self-help. And I think that's perfectly right. The idea that a book, and I have read them all, can help you, it can only help you so far. And people who then go on to say, well, actually, you need the next level, or you need my course, or whatever. Well, that's where the deception and deliberate deception comes in. But I believe a lot of books are helpful, but they're not the answer to everything. And so during my writing of the book, or download, as I like to call it, since it just wrote itself, not pretty, but got itself out, I brought in a very old idea of mine about a triangle, which I have bored people endlessly since. And the triangle pattern stays true, because at the top you need knowledge, and that's where the books come in. You do need knowledge. You need to educate yourself about yourself. And the more knowledge you get, the more tools, which is another bottom of the triangle, the tools you can find to use yourself, But the best thing you need to override is your emotion. And this is where self-help products come in time and time again. They tap into an emotion we want to feel. And we think, read the book, you'll feel the emotion. And it's not true. Emotion is way more complex than that. And emotion is the only thing a book cannot help you with, because it doesn't know you. It can teach you knowledge, it can give you tools, but the emotion, you're kind of on your own. And until you understand that, or even acknowledge or have knowledge about that emotion, you're back on that cycle again, which is how I found myself on a good few decades of cycles.
I think it's so interesting. I was talking to a friend of mine about this, probably around the same time actually you and I were talking, and we've done the self-help thing for probably 10 plus years. And we were saying we felt that we got to like a saturation point with it. We've read all the stuff and we'd learned so much about what can help you should you be able to put it into practice. But we were saying we were still at a point where nothing's changing much. We're learning. We've got all, like you said, all the knowledge. We couldn't learn, I don't think, any more about what it takes to do certain things around self-help, goal setting, for example, or you know, any of those things where you come to it. And I remember why I came to self-help, and I remember the first book I read, which was Jack Canfield's Success Principles, and I found that book and I felt like, oh my, someone's reached inside my brain and I can actually, there's something here that I can actually use. And I've always been able to take parts of these things. I've always been able to think, okay, how could I apply that? But it's never, I guess, lived up to the hype of what's, and it's a $1 billion industry, self-help. Yeah. It's massive, isn't it?
And growing.
And yeah, exactly. And I think you're right. Whereas I'm always a big fan of authors tapping into emotion, I always say you need to meet the reader where they're at when you're writing a book. Mm. So they feel seen and they feel heard and they feel like this is the book for them. I feel like you're right. It's almost like the book is in self-help, can sometimes feel like it's just a stepping stone to now here's my course and now here's my mastermind. And you're kind of like, well, yeah, exactly. And so it's fascinating, isn't it? I think there is a growing feeling around self-help, wellness. People are feeling that they've heard it so much now, but still nothing seems to be.
Yep. We feel worse. I think possibly because of that feedback loop, you feel, oh, I can't even do this. Mm. Or perhaps I'm not savable, or perhaps there isn't an answer, or that energy it takes to go on that ride of belief and be disappointed again, that trough of like a reality. And yeah, I know that ride. And it's only when you understand yourself as a human, which can be understood, but also you as an individual human, then maybe you don't need self-help. Maybe you're all right. It's more like, I was going to say self-comfort, but you kind of fit in your skin when you understand yourself. And then you realize you don't need to be helped. You just need to, be you more perhaps, but you can't say that. That's not a good book, Be You More. I have thought about it, but in a lot of ways, we need to go through these steps of self-help to self-understanding. And then the person maybe gets to it themselves. I just have to be me, which is it. And that brings the calmness that we're looking for, perhaps, or the usefulness. Mine was usefulness. Always felt I needed to be useful, but I could never figure out what my point was, how I was going to be useful.
Mm. I wonder, though, for some people, when they realize that actually it's about just being yourself. I feel sometimes for a lot of people that they don't like who the person is.
The emotion bit, yep.
And it's so difficult because when you realize there is no 5-week course that you can do or that's going to do X, or there's no come along to my day of this and we're going to definitely achieve this by the end of it. All those, which this is more a business thing, which gets on my nerves, is like, you know, 10K months, 100K months.
Oh, and I think.
And it's really hard because you end up feeling like a failure because you think, oh, I've just got to do, I'm just going to read this person's strategy because if I follow this, it's definitely going to work for me this time. It doesn't. You then think, okay, maybe that's the wrong person. I'll go and find someone else. Okay, this time it will work because they've said that they got to whatever, or they lost this many pounds in weight, or whatever it could be. And it's not until you realize that the work has to be done internally first to like and love yourself.
Yeah,
I think before you can change You have to accept who you are.
Yeah. And then you find you perhaps you don't need to change. You don't need to have a 10,000 month, you know, $10,000 pounds a month. You don't need that because you're not proving anything to anyone, because we all know, right, money's great, but at the end of the day, some of the most unhappiest people have tons of money, because money doesn't buy it's kind of like a calmness we're looking for, a sense of like, oh no, this is okay, this is feels good. Feeling is so important. And you can be the richest person in the world and feel rubbish, or you can be the poorest person ever and just feel a sense of, you know, the calmness that comes with accepting, you know, who you are in life, or what life is, or having a philosophy about what life is about. It's really useful, because we're not Christians anymore, or we're not, you know, we don't follow faith routinely. That used to be a great catch-all for people, that they would have that put there and that would be what they believed. And now I think that's all been taken away, and people have to come back to it their own way, or they follow a guru or business guru, you know. They need to have belief in something, and they don't question that until somebody asks them or questions it. And so it does start right at the top with that knowledge of a broad sense of knowledge about stuff.
Yeah, it does. It does. I think it's such a shame that took me a long time. Sounds like it took you a long time to get to that realization of actually it's the internal work, but it's also the fact that what you feel like you're buying or reading with this kind of stuff can sometimes feel as though it's going to be, okay, if you just do this for the next 6 months, this will happen, and then you'll feel like this and you'll make this change. And it isn't. It's, as Mark Manson always talks about in The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, he always says about how life is finding the problems you want to give a fuck about, and the problems that you enjoy trying to find the solutions to, because he said every solution presents more problems. So he said you might think you've got a solution to something, but that solution in itself will provide more problems than you don't have.
I love it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's I remember where I was when I was walking early morning walk. I know you're a fan of an early morning walk as well. Yeah. And I was walking and I was listening to it, and I've listened to the book before twice, and this is the third time, and it was the first time that actually really it leapt out and literally hit me in the face as I was, you know, and you were like, I just stopped walking. I was like, oh my gosh, this is exactly it.
I call it magic because I quite like the word. And also it's like, well, hold on, I've heard this so many times, but actually today it was magic. That bit was magic. And it makes you smile because you go, all right, okay, that's today then. That's where I am. I'm learning this.
You know, but then like you said, it's that emotion piece where actually I can read his book. I love his work. So, I mean, let's just say that. And there's a lot of people whose work I enjoy reading because I like to learn. I'm going to be a lifelong learner, sadly, in terms of this side of things. But what I do love about that was that the realization that this is just life. Life is shit sometimes, and it goes through. It's an experience. And we have to be, if we want to live a life that's slightly more how we want to live it, like he said, we've got to be intentional about the fucks we're giving.
Yeah. You see, at the end bit, we're like, oh, I could have. We're like, if you even get that 10 years before you go, that's a good 10 years of quality. So it doesn't really matter when it comes. But I always felt it was really, really important for me to have a focus in life and to feel useful. So I was an art student. I did art. We did loads of things. I ended up in teaching. But never, never, never did I feel that I'd found my thing. I was always searching. And I look back now and I'm in my 50s, late 50s, and I'm like, did it really take me that long to find this? And I have to answer myself, yes, it did. Because you had to go on all those journeys. You had to explore those things. You had to have those things happen to you that were unsatisfactory. And then you had to learn, because I've learned a lot, before you'd kind of done your apprenticeship. So I have to, could be wrong, but I have to sort of go, you know, that's just what it was. You learn this very late in terms of being a young person. But hey, maybe I'm going on for another 50 odd years. I don't know. So a lot of that was the sort of, oh, well, the desperation of finding the thing that I was going to be useful at led me to keep that consumption of self-development, because I kept thinking, I'm missing something. I get to 50, I'm like, surely I have missed it, or it's not there. And there is a relaxation of it. Then it's like, well, I've either missed it or there isn't something. And like magic, the thing started to emerge over the next few years. It was this.
Yeah.
Couldn't wish it. And I couldn't have done this at 25.
No. But I also think on that, thinking about what you were saying about have I missed it, I sometimes think we consume so much that we don't allow our heads the space to have the freedom to think about what mulling. Is the thing. That we're too busy trying to find the answers in the books and the courses and the podcasts and did all that kind of thing, the doing, and we don't.
Productivity.
Exactly, because we think it's going to be here somewhere. I'm going to turn this page and there's going to be an answer. And there isn't until you take the step back like you did. Yeah. I feel like I have done in the last couple of years has been, I think it's when I hit 40 probably, and I started to think to myself, oh, I started to give less of a shit about what other people thought, which was a really nice part of turning 40 and onwards. But I do think there seems to be this pattern of, we worry what everyone else thinks. We worry we have to conform, fit in and do the things that people expect of us in our 20s. And I found most of my 30s. Mm. I did things that were kind of controversial. Yeah, you know, I left a career, left a teaching career. I dropped out of university. I mean, my poor mum and dad, I'm just like totally the black sheep.
I was just going to say, the rental expectations way heavy when you're younger for some people.
Exactly. But I've always got to a point where I've had enough now. I'm going to do something else. And I just feel like now I'm like, I'm more comfortable to do that. And I'm ready for people's emotional reactions to it. So if I say I'm going to do something and they're like, oh, you sure? Before I'd think, oh no, maybe I'm not sure. Maybe I shouldn't. And I think that idea of getting to a point where you think, do you know, I just want, like you said, you get to the end of life. And I always contemplate this and think, do I want to sit there and be like, oh, I really wish I'd done this, or but I was so worried about if that was the right thing or if that was what people expected. But I never did it. And then I get to the end and be like, well, that was a bit shit.
Very disappointing. It must feel like.
Very disappointing.
That the promise never came about what life was going to be. And I think it can be too much. Like, my daughter's 18 and I think life is very overwhelming. It always is at 18. But then also we've got like life in your hand on a phone. You can see everyone else having a good time. Although they're very savvy Gen Z, they know all the things that are going on online way better than we do because they've grown up with it. But there's still these huge pressures. They're just different pressures. And that's why one can never advise anyone else, because A, we're not living their life. We might not even be their generational equivalent. But also it's a unique experience. So in a lot of ways, we should be doing less advising and more listening while they tell us what's going on. And that way they are telling themselves. So really, it should be a point of which you start a conversation with yourself. But how do you do that? So that's kind of what the Wandering Light Bulb is, which is my newsletter. It's all about that internal introspection, but also somehow nailing that down so you can look at it and go, oh, that's what I thought. How interesting. You know, and start to help yourself.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, literally a self-help. That's how you self-help, by laying something down and then examining it, because you're smart. You can suss it out. You know, we can always help other people better than ourselves.
Yeah, and I think they'll also be far more savvy at perhaps not getting sucked into these promises by the gurus of the world who claim to be able to solve it for us. I think maybe they'll be, like you say, if we're able to listen and they're able to talk about how they're feeling or what they're thinking, they will then come to the conclusions that we've come to, but hopefully far sooner, and be like, actually... Yeah, well, you might be interesting to listen to. And I always like to think that I learn stuff because everyone's always got interesting points to make, right? Even in the self-help world, you might have podcasts that you listen to and you think, oh, that's really interesting. I never thought of them before. But like you say, the big stuff happens when it's self-led, isn't it? It's something that we do because we're secure in who we are. Mm. I just wonder whether, I know you mentioned when we were chatting just at the start, about your triangle theory, and I just love it if you would just be able to elaborate a little bit more on what it is and how it came to be such an integral part of what you do.
Steph, how long have we got? Because I can go on about it. There's a triangle in everything. And I delight, I forget this, and I will tell you what the triangles are in a minute. Every time I start something, like I started this newsletter and I'm like, oh, I'm going to write a newsletter. Everyone should write a blah, blah. You can hear my internal dialogue. Then I realized there was a triangle in it. And I went, of course there's a triangle in it. So the triangle is always point up, and the top point is always the kind of new information, or in the self-help triangle, it's actually knowledge. So you kind of need that start. I've also got a self-help, I've got a triangle about my life where I have at the top is philosophy. So there has to be a solidity about that top bit. That is why it's at the top of the triangle. It has to come from somewhere, or in a business that might be the idea to make something new or to produce something, or the gap in the market. That's almost like the spark, is that top apex. And then down on the two sides, as you look at the triangle on your left-hand side, that's the doing, that's the mechanics, that's the systems, the processes. And so that, and I always say, if it was an engine, the idea of an engine, someone had to invent it, the process would be the physical engine block and how it works, the physics of it. And then finally, on the other side, which is the fluid side, it's the energy or the emotion, or it's, in the case of an engine, it's the petrol, it's the actual something you have to add. And also the will to want to go somewhere. That's the dynamic bit. And so what I found out when examining the idea of a triangle, I do challenge people to send me concepts that don't have triangle, and I will find it. They may not agree, but I'm right. The idea, the knowledge, the actual system, and then the energy for that system to run is, I don't think I've invented anything new. I think you'll find that the philosophers have invented it way before. But mine's a dynamic, you know, it's a living, breathing process. And what I noticed in the emotional bit on the self-development triangle, that can absolutely scupper the knowledge and the, what I call the action. And so if you have a weight loss, yes, we know how to lose weight. We know how to do the exercise. We know how to eat better. We've got all the tools. We've got our measuring. We've got our equipment. We've got our plan. And you can wake up and go, no. Okay. So the head is saying that's a good idea. The tools are there. You're ready to use them. You had an idea. You were going to do this. You were inspired. And then one day, no. So that was what I was interested in. Self-sabotage. I mean, you know, it takes one to absolutely be able to study it. That self-sabotage bit was fascinating. So I realized that knowledge and action totally got overrode by emotion. And so I've studied that a lot. And I've recently been doing work with parts theory, which is where you are lots of different parts, essentially. And one day the meh part is going to go, no, we're not doing that anymore. And we'll somehow override all the parts that were keen to do the weight loss or the fitness or whatever it is, start the business. And so that's extremely fascinating, in as much as that kind of solves the emotional bit where you're not at the mercy of the emotions. You're now at a point where you can be looking at those going, oh, now that's an interesting reaction. Why? You know, stepping out a bit. Why am I having that reaction when I had the plan to lose weight? I had the tools and already, and yet I'm still unwilling to start or to continue, because you could be, you know, months in. And so that's where I am at the moment with the driver of it, is the emotion. You can overcome that. And I think the habits books, which are coming a bit prevalent now about starting something, you can think about starting something, have a plan and just do it almost like robotically. And that does kind of override the emotional something, and then maybe the emotion changes, go, actually I do quite like running, you know, I do quite like yoga, or I do quite like something. You can override it, but you have to know that's what you're doing. You know, to stop emotion sabotaging.
It's so interesting. I was at Carfest last weekend, or bank holiday weekend of August, and Carfest is put on by Chris Evans, and
I know
it's predominantly cars, but it also has other stages. And my very good friend was hosting on the Sparfest stage. So she was interviewing all sorts of people in the wellness space on stage. And she was interviewing a well-known podcaster. And One of the ladies in the audience was talking, put her hand up to ask a question at the end, and she said, and this speaks so to what you were just saying, she said, I just would love to know your opinion on why she bought herself, I think they're a Shakti mats, you know, where they've got like the little needles in. Yeah. She said, I've bought it. I've read about why it's going to help me. She said, I've bought it and I spent £100 on it or whatever it was. And she said, but it's still in the corner in the cellophane, in the wrapping, and I can't get myself to unroll it and actually use it. She said, I know how it's going to help me. I've bought the thing, but I have not taken the wrapping off and it's still in the corner, she said, 6 months later. I said, I just, for some reason, I cannot get over the block of, why can't I unroll this mat? And it was fascinating because everyone was laughing with her. She was laughing herself saying, I just saw so ridiculous. Exactly. And we were all like thinking, she, and, you know, and he was sort of saying to her, maybe it's starting with just a couple of minutes of on the mat. She was, her thing was, she said, I can't even unroll it. No. I can't even get it out.
Don't you find that interesting?
It's fascinating. Just when you said that, I thought that instantly made me think of that woman in her mouth.
There's a really good reason. And that reason will stop her doing anything. Even if someone said, look, I'll give you 100 quid if you'll unroll it. Chances are she'll just go, just not going to. I'm just not going to. And then it is an emotional block there that is possibly nothing to do with health, wellness or anything like that. It's maybe something else. And because we're never given any education to the fact that we might have multiple, not personalities, we don't call it that anymore, but multiple aspects of self. And at any one time, one can be, and I can't say triggered because that's too speak, but that could be just, we could be in that person. We could be in that part of self or reminiscing, reminded of an era, and we're in that one. And we don't know it until we're aware of the parts, and some of them are very scared and some of them are very young because it's very scary to be young generally. And those are the things that are generally stopping us. And the older we get and the more baggage we have attached to them, like barnacles to a boat, and then there'll be barnacles on the barnacles, then, and we don't realize it's a matter of understanding. And you said the L word first. It is about love. It's like, you've got to love those parts of yourself and understand them. We don't criticize them or tell them to shape up or like, don't be so ridiculous. We go in and understand what it was like being them, you know, being ourselves at that point. You don't have to relive the trauma. You don't have to go through, but you do have to go and find other aspects of yourself that are still stamping their foot. You are not unrolling that mat. They're still controlling us. It's fascinating. No one really addresses that. And even in a lot of therapy, don't go anywhere near this. They don't go anywhere near the fact that actually talk to a part of self, find it.
I made me think when you were talking then about those younger parts of you, because I know in the book you have your 14 ladies. And I just wondered whether you could just explain to the listeners who those 14 ladies are and how that links into what we've just been talking about.
Absolutely, because the 14 ladies, I did a lot of neuro-linguistic programming, which everyone goes, oh, like that. But actually, it's just a set of interesting things. It has been absolutely abused in the selling world and in the sort of persuasion world and everything, but it's still the same principles of kind of understanding self. And I came across it quite innocently when I was in my 20s and I was still my teacher training or my first year of teaching. It just happened to appear in the borough that I was a new teacher in, and they gave it to us as a year-long course. Fascinating, life change. So I was on something to do with NLP, and we always had the position where you would advise yourself so you could see, you'd describe a problem, step out of that position, step into another one and advise yourself. So there's a perspective. It's quite simple. And then sometimes if that advisor didn't know what to do, you might step back and advise the advisor. It's actually very simple. And people go, does that work? And it really does. The perspective really works. However, one day I was standing there and I heard, I didn't hear it in my head, but I was aware that something there was going, well, there's 14 of us. Well, like that. And it's not, and I'm like, anyone else see that? So I laugh because obviously that story's embroidered itself over the years. And the ladies have, like I said in the book, and then I completely forgot about it. And maybe I'd come back and now and then. But through the process of trying to understand something, they would occasionally come out. And mine are chronological. So they would, they used to start at 8 and they used to finish at whatever age I was. So they've been 20s, 30s, 40s, is that? But when I started to really look into them, that a 3-year-old appeared. And some other kind of ethereal ones at the end. Then I did parts theory training, which was very recent, and I recently qualified over the summer. And I realized it was barnacles on barnacles. It's not just a neat semicircle arrangement out of my peripheral vision. There are all sorts. It's a wonderful inner gang. They're with me all the time. And it makes you sound nuts. But actually, the more you kind of get comfortable with that, the more you can have a conversation with yourself. Or if you're, I still get very upset about things, and I can be with myself when I'm upset. It sounds mad, but I don't have to, all of me doesn't have to be upset. That part of me that's upset is really upset. And then the other parts can just go, oh yeah, we can see why you're, it does sound really like I've got a multiple personality disorder, but there isn't. It's just me acknowledging the fact they're all very different selves. So my 14 original ladies still stand, but there's all sorts in there now. And it's a very comforting community. This will be the podcast that doesn't get broadcast. It is a very comforting community. You never feel out of resources. You always feel you can empathize with people because there's a part of you in there somewhere that's totally resonating with what someone else is saying. You just can be.
I think that a lot of us don't realize that there are events that happen that shape us, obviously, as we grow. And I think it's only right that we should think back on parts of us that have experienced things that have stuck so much in the narrative we tell ourselves. So I know you talk a lot about internal narrative and story. And I feel that sometimes, so for me, an example that when you were talking made me think was, when I was 13, 14, I was really badly bullied at school. I had a really awful school experience for a little while. And I will revert back to that age. Whenever I go somewhere new and I have to meet new people, I become that person, that 13, 14-year-old me who was desperately shy, hated being the center of attention, would absolutely never put a hand up, you know, all that sort of, you know, typical kind of way when you've maybe had that experience where you just go very into yourself, you just try and hide. And it's really interesting when you say that I think there'll be people listening who will be able to identify parts of their life or periods in their life or the age they were when something happened, but then they can think, yeah, do you know what, I still do that sometimes. Now I go back to that.
That's yes, the part is stuck in that, and until that's even a concept you can acknowledge, you don't necessarily realize. And yet when people realize it, they go, oh yeah, they're almost clamoring in there for attention. You don't need to go back and exercise that memory. You just need to go back to that part and just go, it's all right, look where we are now. What would you like to do? Yeah, there is more to it than that. And if you go to a very good parts therapist, and there are a number that actually understands parts, it can be quite a soothing and lovely process. Some people's parts obviously come out of very difficult circumstances, but they can still be very calmly dealt with. You know, they might come out in a rage, but the part itself is hurting. The part itself cannot hurt you because all it's trying to do is get your attention. So that when you focus on the attention in whatever way, that's when that's what that part wants. It wants your attention. It doesn't want judgment. I've got a friend of mine, we were discussing this on, and she would roundly turn on a part and go, well, why are you like that then? I'm like, no. Have an understanding, like, no, that's, oh, why are you like, you know, almost like, not a stop it, just like, tell me how it is. Like you would with a small child. And that's the way we need to treat ourselves. And it's horrible to hear and see how many people hate themselves somehow. Or, you know, they just want to dissolve themselves and be somebody else.
Yeah. And unless we, like we said right back at the beginning, unless we're willing to do that internal work and go through those kind of processes of learning those parts of ourselves, it's just going to be, you're going to keep looking for external sources to be the answer, when actually the answer is always within. It's just trying to find it and be comfortable knowing that it might be uncomfortable to to the answers you seek, because you have to do the work to uncover them, I guess. But yeah, fascinating. That Park stuff sounds really interesting. I have heard of internal family systems as well.
Yes, which, that's it. Yeah. IFS is one of the parts. There's two or three different ways, but IFS is lovely because it's focused on the client doing, you know, the conversational work. Whereas some other ones would be like the therapist, if you like, working with the client's parts. And IFS, the client itself is seeking the conversation. So there's that third partiness again, which is really important. It's a lovely safe position to be in, is to be that third party kind of observer in yourself. It's wonderful. And don't tell anyone, but I think that just knocks so much as a psychological processes on the head, if only people all kind of had this awareness, or they came across it, or it was not, I don't know, maybe they keep it down, or they just say it's some sort of eccentric thing that some people do as an outlying therapy, you know, it's not given. But actually, there's a lot of people practice the various forms of parts therapy, and they can't, well, I was going to say, if anyone feels like they don't find someone and have a session, it's quite interesting just to hear it and understand it a little bit more. But yeah, I would say that was my 14 ladies that took me to that. I didn't know all that. Then I wrote them in the book, and then I thought, well, I need to find out more. And that led me to actually going on the training. So the book obviously was the catalyst.
Mm, which is amazing. And that's such a nice little easing into, let's talk about the writing. And I wonder, when you were talking there, and you might not want to answer this, and that's okay, of course, but I wonder whether you noticed when you were in the writing process, because you have written before, you've been published before, so this isn't your first book, we'll say, you know, it's not the first foray into publishing, but do you notice you went to a certain age when you were writing? Did you revert to an age maybe when you first wrote, or were you able to sort of disassociate from that?
That's so interesting, because I would say, I would always say I write, but these days, particularly doing the newsletter, or the next book, which is, I actually will say to myself, I love writing. And I would never have seen myself loving writing. It was almost like my first book, I was obliged. I chose to do it, but I was kind of under a little bit of pressure to do it. The second one, this one that I did with you, it had to come out. It had to be born. It was, you know, and so it just came out. But now I'm writing what I know will be my third as a newsletter, as a sort of a piece work. I actually, when I sit down to it, I'm just going, I just love this. I love it. I'm acknowledging that I love it. So when you ask when I come into me, I'm not going anywhere else. I'm actually being very authentically me. And I think because the first book was what it was and the second book was what it is, that this one now is me going, right, well, those two are out of the way. And I'm writing about things I'm interested in, because I'm sure this will come up, but you don't write a book because you know what's in it. You write a book because you kind of got an idea that there might be something there. And only by writing it, do you then look at it and go, cool, wow, that wasn't what I was expecting. So it's like you look at the book and go, that's impressive. You know, because your momentum takes you to a place that you wouldn't have thought of right at the beginning. It's a birthing thing, really.
It is a birthing. Someone once who worked with me once called me a book doula, which I thought was interesting. Yes. I've not heard that expression before.
I've had a doula when I was giving birth. Yes. You need someone there who kind of knows what they're on about. Because when I was published before, it was with a publishing, proper publishing company. I had the editor, I had the person who worked for the company in that steering. Whereas when you publish yourself, which the second book was, I did it through Troubadour, who were excellent, to actually write, they can't write the book, but you need somebody to be with you who has written books, and they don't interfere. They're just there to be with you, like giving birth. They cannot give birth for you, but they can kind of be that perspective on the outside, and you were invaluable. Because I knew I could write, but I didn't know if what I wrote made sense to a lay person. And then your feedback was great. It's like, this is fascinating. This is, have you thought about that? What about this bit? Do you think, you know, and all that sort of tying it together and making it sense enough for me then to take to the copy editor. And then I went into the publishing process. So you made, I'll say, I don't know, it's like a ball of wool. I don't know what it is. It's a mess. You made it into a comprehensive something that then was ready to be copy edited. I mean, it was still miles away from the finished product because obviously, you know, these are, but it was a product. It existed. From nothing came something. And that was entirely what you were invaluable.
Oh, thank you.
But you were, I'm just saying. And I was offered other people from other, and I just like, I just know they're not them.
Thank you. That's
I just, it's just them.
I'm just going to have to make sure my producer doesn't cut this out and she'll be like, no, we're not having any of that in there.
I'll just sprinkle it all the way through. But I think that, as I will say, you need somebody. You can't, well, you know, you can't write in isolation. If you can, and that's one thing, fine. But if you want to be read and understood by other people and leap out and be understood, then you have to share it with somebody.
Yeah. I find it also that often people find the fact that it, like you called it a ball of wool, it's messy, the first attempt at it is just, it is a download and it is a, I always say to people, remember you write the first draft for you, it's for you to get to know the book, what it's about, because you can't do that, exactly like you said, you can't work it all out before you write it down. There's just something about the writing, and I'm sure there's something probably neurologically around the process of writing things down.
I think it's a conversation with yourself.
You exactly.
Start the conversation by producing.
Exactly. And I think when you can just relax into that and realize, actually, not everything that I put down on this first attempt is going to make it to the final edit. Of course it isn't, because there'll be things that need to go and you'll repeat yourself and you'll say things in ways you don't want to particularly say them, but it will do for now. You have to go through that to then get to the finished product. And I think people are so, when you think about writing a book, quite often people will think of the book. They think, oh, I'm going to have this thing in my hand, or be on the shelf in a bookshop or whatever it might be for that particular person. But they forget they have to do the writing bit first. So they've almost got, they can visualize the finished beautiful thing.
Yeah.
The actual writing of it is something then that they don't end up doing, because it's just, well, I just need to know exactly what it's going to be.
It's like a transformation. And I think some people are kind of aware that it's a transformation, but people like me don't, and I should. So I didn't realize what I was going through, what I was going to unearth, what I was going to add in, how I was going to refine it, and what person I would be at the end of it. And now a whole year on, because I think it was, we were doing the copy edits, infinite copy editing this time last year. There's a book and I love it. I love my book, but actually that's the end of an era for me. And it's like, well, that had to exist for me to then have space somehow to be the next thing that I'm being, to have the next level of conversations with myself and other people, and to be that, you know, that's almost like we get that bit out the way. And I think most, I don't know about fiction, because I don't write fiction. I have, but I don't. That might be different, but I do believe stories have to come out as well. I do believe it's a very much a process of creation. It's not about, I know this. It's like, oh, I'd like to write a book about this.
Yeah. And I always say this, because I do write fiction, and I find that I have a loose idea. I always know, so I write cozy mystery, so I always know who's killed who and why. But the other people that are the other suspects or anything like that, they I know why they could be considered to be the people that have done the crime. Yep. But actually, they will often take on like little journeys of their own in a story.
Yes.
Sometimes I come to the end of the story and I think, God, I didn't even, like that person might have been like a thought of a character. Yeah. Now they've really become an important part of it, or somebody I thought would be important isn't, or they to go off on their own little thing. I'm thinking, well, I didn't realize you were going to do that. But I think it's about knowing that that is part of the process, and a normal part of the process, which I think sometimes when it's the first book, people feel like, oh, I should know exactly what's going to happen.
It's a delightful thing to it. These characters are, maybe they're like parts. Maybe it's a part, because each of them are part. They don't necessarily know each other. So I wonder if somehow you're tapping into parts of yourself that have got their own little life going on, or, you know, there's a little fantasy going on. I did that myself, you know, NaNoWriMo.
Yeah.
So I did that one year, yonks ago. And the story that came out, I was horrified by, because it just wrote itself and all the characters went off and did these things. So it's quite an easy process. But I totally get that the characters tell you their story and you just type it. It's fascinating. I mean, you have obviously got a little bit more control and you've actually got a plot. I didn't. It just wrote itself. So that's what's fascinating. And I think non-writers or people who are aspirational writers but haven't written anything yet don't understand that aspect of self almost that goes into exploration of self.
Yeah, and it is something where you learn a lot about yourself. Mm. And I wonder whether, do you feel that you're in the middle of writing your third book or in the process of kind of pulling it together, do you feel that you're a different writer than you were even before you, you know, since writing your second book? And are you then a different writer to the one that wrote the first?
So I'm now a writer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I would term it. I'm also an artist, which took me even longer to kind of get my head around, even though I did art and I went to art college, an art teacher, that took way longer. I was somehow more comfortable with being a writer than I am with being an artist, which I find quite interesting. But yes, I've been published. I have written my own book, but now I'm a writer because writing's part of what I do now. Communication via written word, mm-hmm. rather than writing. And the more you want to learn something, the more you should write it because you'll learn by writing. It's you start the puzzle and then the bits have to be filled in. So you have to research them or learn them or think about it, mull on it and have your own opinion. So yeah, that's very different. I think that's the first time I've said that out loud. Thank you.
You're very welcome. It's not the first time I've heard it, though, because interestingly, whenever, and I've had people, like you say, you've been published. I had the lovely Dr. Emma Hepburn on the podcast, and she's been published by Hachette or an imprint of Hachette. And she said to me that she's written three books now and she still can't call herself an author. And I find it fascinating. And she's not the only one. It's so interesting that people feel like there's almost like a, I don't know whether it's a level, you know, like it's a
but
game.
You see as a writer as somebody who's got this wonderful, yeah. you know, cabin and they've got these quills or whatever it is. There's a vision of a writer that we do not match up with and yet to the outside world. They go, how many books? Yeah. So I would say writer, you said author, which is, I think, very different. Mm-hmm. I'm not an author. I'm a writer. I can write. I'm not an author.
Why not? Why do you think? Okay.
You know, I think an author might be fiction and in my world.
Yeah.
A writer is someone who can write and produce written work. Now, I'm not saying I can write copy, pretty hopeless at writing copy, if you like, for like, you know, an advert or for a course or anything. But to come up with short essays, which is actually what my newsletter is, it's short essays in a formula, that's a triangle. I can do that. I can sit down and do 1,000 words and know that I can write. So that's the process of writing where author's like a label, isn't it?
Yeah, so interesting because societal terms would say you are an author because you've written two books that are published. So I am a firm believer and we should just call ourselves what we feel comfortable with. But I think it's the whole label thing for some people is a really difficult one. And I used to say, I used to be a teacher, but yeah. I also write.
Yeah.
And then it took me a long time to stop saying I used to be a teacher because it would have been like, I think it had been like 3 years and I didn't set foot in a classroom. So I had to really lean into the discomfort of calling myself a writer and an author. But now I do it and I don't even think twice about it. But it is certainly something that we feel as creatives, like you said, with the art. But it's like, when do we feel comfortable enough to call ourselves that? For ourselves, but also knowing that as soon as I say to someone, oh, I'm an author, or you'd say I'm an artist, it would be that it opens up a conversation, doesn't it? People are like, oh gosh, what have you written? Or, you know, what have you painted? Or what have you, you know, sculpted? Or whatever it could be. And it's about, you know, being comfortable with those conversations, but also with the label itself. It's really interesting, I find.
And also, when we were growing up, people said, well, there's no money in that. No one
yes.
reads these books. You're not going to get, weren't going to be an artist. You're not going to be like on telly as an art. You know, that whole thing about these are things that people do around the edges of work. So in a lot of ways, if you were a certain age back along and you said, oh, I'm an artist, everyone would go, yeah, you're on the dole then, you know, that kind of reaction. So actually come out and confident, and they're looking at you going, well, you clearly earn a living out of it because you don't look destitute, you know. And that is a bit of a style you need to rock sometimes, and just say, well, no, I do this. And then they've got that, well, oh, then what else do you do? And it's like, this is what I do. And that is a level of, that whole thing about financial security or being able to generate income from something is still a bit of an unusual feeling.
Yes.
Certainly from the outside that aren't writers, artists.
No. Yeah, I agree. Now, we are coming to the end, and I always ask people, because a lot of people that listen to the show are aspiring writers, authors, or in the throes of maybe their first book. I would love to know from you if you could just give them a piece of advice about either the writing process, or in the case of what we've been talking about today, kind of stepping into the person that they would like to be, or, you know, that maybe they've been looking for answers somewhere when we've been talking about it's all internal. What do you think would be helpful to writers and authors out there who maybe, you know, are trying to get this book together?
I did have a lovely piece of advice, but the way you introduced that made me think, well, everyone's so different and they're at such different stages and they've got so many different influences. So I would say, just really don't do it by yourself. You can write by yourself, but don't stay by yourself. Don't stay in a little cocoon wondering if it's any good and put it in the drawer. Try and find somebody, and if necessary, find somebody who's a professional that you pay, so they give you an honest reflection and hear what's great about it. Because there will be something great about it, because you're human. We want to hear what you've got to say, whatever that might be. But if someone then can reflect back something that's great about it and you believe them, then I think that's a great way of maybe in your head becoming someone who can write or might be a writer. But that sense of it just, you know, going round and round in your head, it needs to see the light. One of my things, I think it's in the book, is to cause potential to find light. That was something that came out very early in my life. What I do is cause potential to find light. So the idea is a book is potential, but like a little plant, it needs to find some light before it's a book. So share it with someone, but don't share it someone who's not going to get it or not going to understand it or go, oh, is that again? Or like, oh, that's nice. So share it with someone that does have no invested interest in it at all, like a professional, and they'll reflect back what's good.
They should do anyway.
You choose the right person for you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's been a delight, and thank you for coming on. And I really am looking forward to people listening to this, because I think we've touched on some really interesting topics as we've been chatting.
It's been a pleasure. I love the whole premise of what you're doing about creating happy writers, because I believe there is probably one in everyone. So it's been delightful. Thank you, Steph.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode of Behind the Book. I hope George's insights about self-help, personal growth, and the writing journey have inspired you. If you'd like to learn more about George's work, you can visit her website, which I'll link to in the show notes. I'll also share a link to her book too. And remember, while external knowledge and tools are very valuable, true transformation starts from within. Until next time, happy writing.